And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, we're 1 year in just about on Joe Biden's administration. Has it been a good year or a bad year? What can we say about his strategy? What can we say about what's next? I know there's a lot of Democrats who are very unhappy and calling for a reset in strategy. What do you think?
Well, it's been a little bit of both. It's both been good and bad. I think the first 6 months were pretty good. He got a lot of the vaccines out there. He got the several bills passed, the infrastructure bill passed. Finally, the economy bounced back, jobs came back, stock market came back. So that part was looking pretty good. I think the inflection point was something that people don't talk about much anymore, and that was Afghanistan, the withdrawal, because how messy it was, and people could see that. And that kind of shattered the thought of competence in the administration, whether it was all his fault or not his fault, the fact that there was no plan left from the Trump administration, but they really didn't have much of a plan either. I think that created a problem. And then, of course, we got into this circular firing squad among the Democrats regarding getting the infrastructure bill passed and then the Build Back Better bill passed. And they couldn't get out of each other's way, and everybody wanted to have it their way. And then letting the good be the enemy of, or letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. So those things didn't occur. And when that didn't occur, we wound up, he wound up then shifting over to the voting rights, which his base was demanding. And of course, the plain fact is he didn't have the votes for it. Now, one thing in terms of strategy that I think can be faulted is in some ways they were over-promising things. They should have always hedged their bets on that we hope to do this, we're going to try like hell to do this, and if we don't do this, it's not because we didn't try or not because the overwhelming amount of Democrats in Congress didn't try. The fact of the matter is we just didn't have enough Democrats. The Republicans sat by the side and put zero on the table. And so the remedy is not to punish the Democrats. The remedy is to punish the Republicans and to elect more Democrats. And that should be their strategy.
Well, Biden came to power based on his statement that he could work with various cliques within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and he could forge a consensus in that way. That was never true. He couldn't do it. McConnell made sure that the Republicans weren't going to cooperate. McConnell made sure that Republicans especially could not cooperate on voting rights and on the infrastructure. And those were the two things he wanted to do. With McConnell making that clear, isn't it incompetent strategy to say that's what I'm going to do? Well, that's what I can do?
Yeah, like I said, that was the overpromise.
Yeah. But the thing is, that's his promise. People like the Third Way, the what are called centrist Democrats, are blaming the Progressive Caucus. But it's Biden's promises that were wrong. All the Progressive Caucus did was support Biden's promises. The Third Way type caucuses, the Problem Solvers caucuses, They did not support Biden's promises. That's the fact. That's very interesting.
Yeah, but in the Senate, they had essentially both groups. The House, Pelosi got her group together, but it was messy. It was messy, and they fought in public rather than in private.
But in the Senate, they couldn't do that.
No, they couldn't do it because the Senate, you know, the Senate has changed. Look at the voter rights bill. The last time it came up for renewal, and I'm not sure why it periodically has to come up for renewal, but when it came up for renewal, I mean, I know technically why, because it was in the previous bills. It has to be renewed every so often. But they did that
as a concession to the right-wingers who wouldn't have voted for it otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. The fact is, the last time it came up, it passed the Senate unanimously. It was like 97 or 98 to nothing.
There's an important thing about the voting rights bill, and that is that voting rights are now understood to be a concession made to the African-American community. And the racists are not going to put up with that.
Well, I mean, we knew from the beginning it had to do with the African-American community. Let's face it. But the fact of the matter is, the racists are no longer ashamed of showing their racism.
That's right. That's exactly what's changed.
That's what's changed.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes back to the Stuart Stevens, the Republican strategist who said, we thought that this was a recessive gene in our party. It turns out it's the dominant gene. And, it goes back after Mitt Romney lost, they went ahead and they did this autopsy, and they said, you've got to be more welcoming and more open.
And
they said, thank you, but no thanks. We want to be what we are, and we want to be twice as bad as what we are.
Yeah. Well, how do you get around that?
You have to elect more Democrats. That's how you get around it.
But how do you get to do that?
Well, that now is the problem that America's facing, democracy is facing, the way that the Republicans are trying to rig the elections.
By the way, I don't know if you need more Democrats like Kyrsten Sinema.
Well, that's a question. But if you had 53 Democrats in the Senate, you wouldn't. She'd be irrelevant. So they could do it without her vote. So, but the thing is, the way that the Republicans have been since particularly 2010. Gerrymandering, for one, voted after the Supreme Court, what was it 2013, gutted the Civil Rights Act. They went beyond just gerrymandering. They went passing bills that made it harder for Democratic constituencies to vote. And now they're now turning their back. It's not good enough. What they found out is their policies are not appealing to the majority, but they won't change their policies. They're saying, we're going to make our minority policies the law of the land, whether you folks like it or not. And if gerrymandering doesn't do it, if voter suppression doesn't do it, we're going to change the methodology to make sure that only our votes count. It's the Stalinesque theory that who counts the votes or what it's important. Now, they've run into some roadblocks in that. There have been some surveys. They thought that with the dominance of Republican legislatures, that this year's redistricting, reapportioning of the congressional districts, would strip Democrats of anywhere from 5 to 7, maybe more people's votes, or more votes in Congress because of the shifts. And it turns out that it's looking more and more like it's just going to be a wash, or maybe only one or two. Ohio just ran into a problem, the Republicans there, because they defied the mandate of the people. The people voted to have a nonpartisan type of congressional map making, and the legislature went ahead and they gerrymandered terribly. And the Ohio Supreme Court this week struck that down. They said, when we live in a state where mostly at best you get 55% of the vote, and you guys have structured it so you get 75-80% of the congressional districts. We're not going to go for that. And the fact of the matter is the deciding vote was done by a Republican chief justice. North Carolina is still up in play whether their gerrymandering is going to happen. There's still places where it occurs. Maryland, they're gerrymandering more for the Democrats. We have to see what comes out of New York on that, since the Democrats have better control there. But that's always been a little tenuous. Some of the Democrats vote like Republicans up there. We'll just have to see how these things play out. We're still waiting to see how Pennsylvania plays out right now in their redistricting. They haven't agreed on maps. There's one that passed the House. It may not pass the Senate. And it's going to be close in Pennsylvania. Right now it's a 9-9 split. Since we're losing a congressman, it's going to have to be a 9-8 split. The parties are lucky, and we don't know which way that's going to go.
Well, you're not sure it'll be 9-8. It used to be what? No. 13-5.
13-5. Yeah, that was the one that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania nixed. They said no, that was a rig, and it went too far. And as soon as they changed the boundaries, they made them more contiguous and more reasonable. It went to 9-9.
But let me go back on something that's not just structural. Not that I want to downplay what's structural, but
right.
Biden, as you point out, had a great victory, and even two great victories, in the first 6 months, none of which is remembered.
Right.
Now, I think back to Franklin Roosevelt, who faced many of the same problems that Biden faces, because if you remember, when Roosevelt was elected, there was a significant movement to organize an actual military coup to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
It failed, of course, as we know. But,
right.
But what most people don't know is that it took place. But it did take place.
Right.
Well, without getting into that history, the thing that Roosevelt did was when he passed the first of the great bills, or the first and second of the great bills that provided for the huge expansion of government programs to employ people, he put the social worker, Harry Hopkins, in control of that process and told him, hire people. Just get them working. Make sure people feel this. Don't worry about overspending. Don't worry. There's going to be some corruption. There's going to be mismanagement. There's going to be all of this. Forget about it. Just get people working. And Hopkins did it and had, I think he hired several million people within the first few months. And people therefore felt what the New Deal was all about. That didn't happen with Biden. Biden got these laws passed. In other words, if you look at it, a military analogy, Biden had a breakthrough. In military combat, in a land war, if you have a breakthrough, if you penetrate the enemy lines, you flood that hole. You roll back the enemy as far as you can, as fast as you can. You don't piecemeal your troops. In civilian politics, the analogy to that is do what you've just been given the right to do. Do the enemy has been not doing. Now you have the right to do. Do it. Doesn't matter how you'll have to fix it later. Make the impact. That's the way messaging should get done. If he had done that, if the administration had been set to act in that way, you wouldn't have to talk about messaging. You wouldn't have to worry about people being disaffected. Nothing is done, even though something had been done. You wouldn't see young people be feeling, disappointed, black people, Hispanics, women feeling disappointed, and that's what the polling shows, because there would be momentum. But there, as the first Bush said, there's no mo, right?
Yeah. Well, let me, I agree with you on the idea of momentum. I think momentum is very important. Where I have some questions on your thesis is the fact that we live in a different environment than Franklin Roosevelt. First of all, Biden didn't have great control of the Congress. Roosevelt had a little bit better. That got even better after 1936. But
in 1933 he didn't have that.
But it wasn't this
Hopkins
close.
Did what he had to do.
Yeah, it wasn't as close. But back then Franklin Roosevelt didn't have a Fox TV working against and propagandizing. He didn't have years of Rush Limbaugh propagandizing against the ideals. He didn't have Republican governors who stood in the way of things that we have. And when I'm saying stay in the way, I'm talking about the virus. Don't forget, the virus was never fully controlled. And
it's not controlled right now, as we're sitting talking.
It isn't. And a good part of that is because people like Abbott in Texas and DeSantis and in Florida and Noam up in the Dakotas and go down the list of red states have decided that they're going to play politics with a virus and they're going to set policies that allow it to spread. And that what their messaging was taken up by or just added to the things that they heard on Fox and on Newsmax and OAN and all of those places. So it's just a totally different thing. It's one thing, Roosevelt created jobs. Well, so did Biden. People are back working. People are leaving jobs because they can get better jobs in large part. Wages are up for a while. So that's not Biden's problem. But Biden's problem is that there's still this sickness that's going around that can't be controlled at this point. And there also is this opposition to the second half of what he wants to do. But what he wants to do in the second half, that Build Back Better, is more of a long-term thing. All over the country, Republicans are going ahead on the infrastructure bill and praising it, when they get funding, when funding comes in for a bridge or a new road or something else, they're right in front cutting ribbons, and even though they voted against it. That has to be taken on a more of an individual basis. The people in those states have to go on it, but it's pretty hard. That's a one-day story type of thing.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, he made a speech this week, Biden, about bridges, about all the money that's going to be spent on rebuilding bridges, and that reaches into every community.
Right.
Why didn't he make that speech 8 months ago? Why didn't he immediately start issuing contracts? That would have hired a lot of people. Visible. It had nothing to do with the governors. If they wanted to come out front, he could have. On that situation, he probably could have said, hey, and by the way, you want the job? Wear a mask.
Well, I think he said that. Federal jobs, they have to.
I understand that. But the point is, if he had expanded federal employment through the infrastructure bill that had passed 8 months ago, if he had concentrated on that, I think you'd have had a different political situation in the country. Instead of concentrating on that, he concentrated on backroom negotiating with Sinema and Manchin, which got him nowhere, and apparently stood in the way of mobilizing the forces within the administration, the bureaucratic forces within the administration that needed to be mobilized to get the money out the door and get the programs working. That's key. I think that's key. That's what administration is all about. That's the political aspect of administration.
Yeah. We'll see. Is that these things are coming on board now, and they're going to keep coming on board. We'll see about that. But I still think that there's there's still bigger issues, and this voting is one. And you also had when Herbert.
Well, voting is one, but what they don't pay attention to, and I don't think the John Lewis bill. Pays attention to this, or the other bill pays attention to this, the counting of the vote, the administration of the vote, the period between Election Day and the certification, which is the period that the Trump forces concentrated on to make sure that the votes were not certified or that they could be discarded, that the legislators, the Republican legislators, could take results that they don't like and just say, I'm not going to pay attention to those results. I'm going to certify other votes.
Yeah, well, you got to remember, certain functions in the Constitution are left to the states, and even those that aren't, the election is by 50 separate states in the District of Columbia. It's not by the nation as a whole.
No, but the federal laws can mandate that the states follow certain procedures and avoid certain other procedures.
Yeah, and we're going to see how that plays out. We could still find out, for instance, right now, and Rachel Maddow did a wonderful job this week bringing out this, that there is apparently a plot or some sort of a conspiracy or some movement behind the scenes that tied into the January 6th or the night of the 5th proceedings with the Eastman memo
the memo that John Eastman, this lawyer, wrote, laying out step by step how Pence could throw out the electoral votes from six or seven states, right?
That were already certified by the states, and
what he found is that there
was in either five or maybe now up to seven states, a rogue group got together and sent in a phony certification, saying that we are the electors, even though that we lost, even though that the popular vote was for Biden in Arizona and Georgia, and Nevada. Pennsylvania, we're signing, Wisconsin, I think was one of the states. We're signing saying, no, we are the duly appointed electors, even though they, matter of fact, some of them weren't even on the pre-list of electors. And we're saying, and there's actually there's film of these people signing these phony documents that we're casting our electoral votes, even though we don't have any for Donald Trump.
Why isn't that a criminal act? Why isn't that a violation of all kinds of laws?
It may be. This stuff is just coming out. That may be a criminal act. That might be fraud. It might be mail fraud, sending it through the mails to the National Archives.
It's certainly trying to impede government operations.
Yeah, and that may come out yet. And these folks, they put their John Hancocks on this stuff. So we know
don't insult John Hancock.
I know. But, I want to get back to one thing. In the 1932 election, Herbert Hoover was defeated, and he went away. Donald Trump did not go away. Donald Trump is still orchestrating this. The opposition to Franklin Roosevelt did not have a figure to lead them. The opposition to Joe Biden still has this Trumpian figure. Now, Trump may be losing a little bit of his persuasion. Don't forget, he's not on Twitter or whatever, Facebook right now. We've seen this week where Senator Mike Rounds, came out saying that Trump lost the election, but is not suffering any consequences for it, at least not immediately. So we're going to have to see. But
Trump said about him: is he stupid or is he crazy?
Yes. He's not stupid. He's not crazy. He's realistic. But Trump, this is the way that Trump operates. And Biden still has to live in that reality that Trump is out there. And until the big lie is squashed. And this week, of course, we had criminal proceedings finally brought on a count of sedition. Up to now, the people who were involved in January 6th were charged with things like trespassing or interfering with a government operation, as you mentioned, but nobody was charged with sedition. We now have this group so charged, and we'll see what else.
And the guy who's charged, the guy who founded the Oath Keepers, he's a fellow who graduated from Yale Law School. He's not a dope.
Oh, I've been talking about this for a long time. I sent a note to the constitutional law professor up there, Akil Amar. He hasn't responded to me. He speaks in Scranton. Every time he has a new book, he comes down. He's invited to the Schemmel Forum at the university. And I listed all these guys, Tom Cotton, Ben Sasse, J.D. Vance, Mike Pompeo, DeSantis, the whole host of them, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, who've all gone to either Harvard or Yale law schools, and said, where have you guys failed? Where has the elite education failed? There's an article in The Atlantic this week about that, that I stumbled on. I sent a copy to the person who runs the Schemmel Forum and said, kind of, you heard it from me first. you know, that kind of thing. So, it goes to show that even a good education doesn't necessarily matter.
No, education has nothing to do with it. Your ideas, character. Your ideology, that has what's to do with it.
Yeah.
Your education, then you use either to promote the truth or to twist the truth.
Yeah, but what shapes your ideology? What changes when you were in the Senate the last time that they vote that voted for the Civil Rights Act, and now you won't? You know.
Well, you guessed that about Kyrsten Sinema. What changes when you've campaigned as a member of the Green contingent, as a member of the Green Party, and now all of a sudden you're one of the biggest beneficiaries of Big Pharma and big corporate interests?
Yeah.
You know, that happens.
Yeah. You know, I saw something about her the other day. She did not take the oath on a Bible. And she did not proclaim any religiosity during her campaign. And now you see her with wearing a cross on her necklace.
Well,
maybe she found religion, but maybe it's the wrong religion.
She found religion. It's called the Mammon, the god Mammon.
Yeah. By the way,
now let me ask you something. This, of course, you brought something up about education. I'm just wondering, because you're a lawyer, you've gotten this kind of background, you've gotten this kind of training. Can you remember what was the central point of the Lincoln-Frederick-Douglass debate?
The central point is there was no Lincoln-Frederick-Douglass debate. But you have to tell that to a state representative in Virginia who wants to require education to talk about our founding documents and principles and histories, and that's one of the things he wanted to include was the Lincoln-Frederick-Douglass debate.
What he had in mind was the Lincoln-Stephen-Douglass debate. What he didn't have in mind, what he thought he had in mind.
I guess so, yeah. Listen, I want to talk about one other thing, because we're talking about the Senate, and one of the battles in the Senate is going to be here in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And we have Dr. Oz right now and Dave McCormick, the hedge fund guy, both of whom live out of state, fighting it out, promoting their ideas, attacking each other, attacking Biden, they're attacking China, they're doing whatever they can on that. That's going to be something that's very, very interesting. And we have, you know, talk about ridiculousness or education. We have a guy running for governor here, Doug Mastriano, who's one of the Republicans who wants to still do the recount in Pennsylvania. He opened his gubernatorial campaign this week by wearing a Jewish prayer shawl and blowing a shofar.
All right, that's enough. We can't go further. That's too ridiculous.
That's too ridiculous?
Too ridiculous.
Well, he pulled Teddy Daniels out of the congressional race to run for lieutenant governor with him, which may be more ridiculous. It's going to be a heck of a team.
Well, we stop at that. We've run out of time.
Okay.
You can't really go beyond that. You can't top that.
Or bottom that.
Or bottom that. See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City, 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.